Governor Pat McCrory signed the law that night. The new law denies transgender people use of the bathroom, changing room, or locker room that matches their gender identity. Resistance to the bill is fierce and growing daily. HB 2 was rushed into law in response to the expansion of the anti-discrimination ordinance in Charlotte, North Carolina, passed just over a month ago. Charlotte had added protections for sexual orientation and gender identity. The state law bans local governments from making any such accommodation, rendering Charlotte's inclusive ordinance illegal. Similar bills have been put forth in states from Washington State to Virginia and everywhere in between, writes Chase Strangio, a staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union. He said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
the larger context in which these laws are playing out is deeply disturbing. And the North Carolina law is almost, a greatest hits of all of the terrible things we've seen in the almost 200 bills that have been introduced targeting LGBT people this year.
So the ACLU filed suit challenging the constitutionality of HB 2.
You pass an unconstitutional law Wednesday night, we're going to sue you on Monday morning.
We spoke with one of the plaintiffs in the federal lawsuit, Peyton McGarry, a 20-year-old sophomore at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, the site of the legendary Woolworth lunch counter sit-ins against segregation in 1960. Of the immediate impact on his life, McGarry said,
"It's requiring me to use the female restroom. This is distressing because I used the female restroom until it was not feasible for me to, until I was getting pushed, shoved, slapped, screamed at every time I went into a female bathroom."
ACLU attorney Chase Strangio concurred.
But it also means that trans people are now completely unable to participate in public life because trans people have no idea where they're supposed to go to the bathroom.
The bathroom ban is a symptom of systematic institutionalized discrimination against transgender people. Last year, more transgender people were murdered in the United States than in any previous year. In particular, Chad Griffin, president of Human Rights Campaign, writes, "Transgender women of color are facing an epidemic of violence that occurs at the intersections of racism, sexism, and transphobia." A survey of nearly 6,500 people in the United States who identify as transgender that was conducted by the National LGBTQ Task Force and the National Center for Transgender Equality found that respondents were four times more likely to live in poverty than the average American. A stunning 41% had attempted suicide. As HB 2 became law, Charlotte marked the one-year anniversary of the suicide of Blake Brockington, the first transgender high school homecoming king in North Carolina. In a video film before his death, 18-year-old Brockington said,
"I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, in a Southern Baptist home. I've always been kind of different, and it was always a bad thing in my family. It's been really hard. High school's been really hard."
Blake Brockington talked about being crowned homecoming king.
"Made me feel like for once I could just be a normal teenage boy. Just a normal teenage boy, just doing normal teenage guy things. Like being homecoming king, that's a normal teenage boy thing."
North Carolina's Attorney General Roy Cooper, who is running for governor against Pat McCrory, announced he would not defend the new law in court. More than 90 major corporate CEOs, including those from Apple, Google, Facebook, Marriott International, and the Charlotte-based Bank of America, have signed a letter to Governor McCrory saying, quote, "We're disappointed in your decision to sign this discriminatory legislation into law. The business community, by and large, has consistently communicated to lawmakers at every level that such laws are bad for our employees and bad for business," they wrote. The NBA said it may pull its 2017 All-Star game from Charlotte. Facing comparable pressure in Georgia, Republican Governor Nathan Deal vetoed a similar bill this week. Peyton McGarry sees hope in the reaction, both on his own campus and around the country.
"Now this is really bringing people together and making people realize that this is a threat to our movement to accept each other and our movement to love each other."
Let's celebrate love, acceptance, and equality. Take American politics out of the toilet. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And you're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Mike Murphy, and Jeff Humfeld and Judy Ansel are here. And good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, and Judy will be back in the studio here in just a moment. We are going to be talking with Amy later in the hour. She is going to come on. But we do want to remind you about the event on this coming Saturday, April 9th. It's going to be from 7:30 to 9 p.m. And that's going to be at the All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. And if you're looking for tickets, Bill Sundahl is the person. And I've got a couple different things here, and I'm not sure exactly which one to give you. You can send an email to events, that's event plural, at kkfi.org, and that will send, and then also you can go to the KKFI website. And there will be a link there that you can go to get tickets. The tickets are $22 for the event. And the I take it that the VIP little food thing at the beginning with Amy is sold out. So you missed out on that, but you can still check out the event when she comes and speaks, and her and Dennis both. We'll talk about their new book, which is Democracy Now. I got to turn it around to read it. 20 years covering the movements, changing America. And that's with Amy Goodman and David Goodman, her brother, as well as Dennis Moynihan. And we know Dennis here at KKFI, a longtime friend, as well as Amy. So, Judy?
Hi.
How are you this morning?
Pretty good. Pretty good. You know, I misread the title. It says on this book, Democracy Now, in big letters, and then it says 20 years in script covering the movements, and I thought it said Charging America, which I think would be appropriate, too, because so much of what Amy Goodman does is like charging the crimes of imperialism and other faults. It's not too kind to... our government sometimes, but it's a great show. I love it. So what do we have up for this hour? I know Amy's coming on in about a half hour, right?
That's right. Okay. So Amy's got a very busy schedule, and she's was at an event yesterday in Ithaca up till 2:30, doing Democracy Now this morning, and
listening to her schedule. And on Saturday, when she finishes off her day here, she's going to be in St. Louis, Columbia, and Kansas City all on Saturday, which is that's a hectic schedule.
Those St. Louis and Columbia ones look like drive-bys.
Really?
She's got her St. Louis thing is at noon, and her Columbia thing is at 3, and it's 2 hours away.
Let's hope she makes it on time. But anyway, there's a chapter in the book about what happened at University of Missouri, Columbia, with the hunger strike and strike of the football team last year. Mm-hmm. This book is very up to date and has a big chapter on the Black Lives Matter movement and everything from Trayvon Martin up to Michael Brown and the Ferguson protests, and covering that, and what the significance of that is. It's a very contemporary book, and of course we're going to have the books there at the event on Saturday. People can purchase them. Is that right, Mike?
That's right. That's right. And Amy and Dennis will be available to sign them. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. And the other co-author is David Goodman, Amy's brother. He's not coming along.
Not coming along, but I do know he is making some of the stops, but just not here.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And we want to thank Rainy Day Books for working with us on this to get the books and make sure we have an adequate supply.
Yeah. And Amy always likes to work with like independent book sellers in each in the community, partly because to support the independent rather than the big corporations, but also because that's if you just sell them out of your trunk, that doesn't count towards getting like on the New York Times bestseller list or anything like that. So it has to go through like an authorized bookseller, I think. Is.
And her books have been bestsellers.
They have, yeah.
Right.
Well, I think this is one of the things that a lot of us don't recognize about Democracy Now, and that is that it is listened to on Wall Street. It's listened to in Washington, D.C. It's listened to in state capitals, too. A lot of these politicians pay attention to what happens on this show because they know that it's she's talking about the issues of the day, and even if they disagree with everything that she does, they want to know what it is she's saying because she is influential. And the fact of the matter is that this is not just a American radio show. I happened to go on their website last night, and they had North America, and you could click on any state or province in Canada to find out what radio stations in that area were playing Democracy Now, or what TV stations, and also so. You know, but they're also international in the Middle East. They're
it's playing global. Yeah,
yeah. A number of places across the country. I mean, the globe that know about and listen to Democracy Now.
According to the dust jacket on the book, the show airs on 1,400 public television and radio stations. So I think they started with five.
I think it was eight or ten.
Yeah, okay.
Lil O.K. KFI was one of them.
We were one of the first.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, geometric growth. Talk about success. You know, and it would be interesting to be able to estimate how many people are regular listeners. I don't know how you would do that. But, you know, it's interesting because a friend of mine texted me yesterday who's in some small town in Illinois. And my friend Jeannie, uh-huh. And she said, well, you know, she loves Democracy Now, and she listens to it on the internet. And, I don't know if she streams KKFI or not, but anyway, she listens to it on the internet. And she said, it's really a shame that it just doesn't reach that many people. And I texted her back, and I said, 1,400 stations. And she said, you made my day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's more than Clear Channel owned at its peak, right? More stations than I think.
It could very well be.
Yeah. I think that was around 1,100
or 1,200. It says it's the largest public, public distribution. Let me read this. It's the largest public media collaboration in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. So, of course, public. It's not, you know, for profit. We're not counting the for-profit or commercial stations.
Right.
But still, yeah. I mean, that's bigger than All Things Considered.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
There you go.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, wait. I was wondering, maybe we opened up the program with Amy's weekly podcast, which is basically her reading her weekly column, and I don't know if it still is, but at one time it was in the Examiner. I don't know if it still is syndicated in the Examiner here locally. I don't read that.
You know, the last time I was out at the grocery store that I go to and eat breakfast at occasionally, and they have the Examiner out there, and I didn't think to look for it, but the Examiner was carrying it, and hopefully still is. They, you know, for a newspaper in this part of the country, they're actually a fairly progressive paper. They cover some things locally and nationally that, you know, a lot of the local news doesn't cover.
So I was thinking that for a little sense of nostalgia, we could air one of Amy's podcasts from the past where she talked about our very own Judy Ansel.
Oh, boy, I don't know if I'm nostalgic about that.
The good old days, huh?
The good old days when you're under attack.
Yeah, let's hear this.
Electronic brown shirts trumped again. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Judy Ansel, a Kansas City, Missouri professor, and her St. Louis colleague were teaching a labor history class together this spring semester. Little did they know, video recordings of the class were making their way into the thriving Sub Rosa world of right-wing attack video editing, twisting their words in a way that resulted in the loss of one of the professor's jobs amidst a wave of intimidation and death threats. Fortunately, reason and solid facts prevailed, and the videos ultimately were exposed for what they are: fraudulent, deceptive, sloppily edited hit pieces. Right-wing media personality Andrew Breitbart is the forceful advocate of the slew of deceptively edited videos that target and smear progressive individuals and institutions. He promoted the videos that purported to catch employees of the community organization Acorn assisting a couple in setting up a prostitution ring. He showcased the edited video of Shirley Sherrod, an African-American employee of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which completely convoluted her speech, making her appear to admit to discriminating against a white farmer. She was fired as a result of the cooked-up controversy. Similar video attacks have been waged against Planned Parenthood. Judy Ansel has been the director of the University of Missouri Kansas City's Institute for Labor Studies since 1988. Using a live video link, she co-teaches a course on the history of the labor movement with Professor Don Giljam, who teaches at University of Missouri St. Louis. The course comprises 7-day-long interactive sessions throughout the semester. Their video recorded and made available through a password-protected system to students registered in the class. One of those students, Philip Christofanelli, copied the videos, and he admits on one of Breitbart's sites that he did, quote, give them out in their entirety to a number of my friends, unquote. At some point, a series of highly and very deceptively edited renditions of the classes appeared on Breitbart's website. It was then that the lives of Ansel and Giljam were disrupted, and the death threats started. A post on Breitbart's BigGovernment.com summarized the video. It said, the professors not only advocate the occasional need for violence and industrial sabotage, they outline specific tactics that can be used. Professor Judy Ansel responds.
I was informed that this video was up on Andrew Breitbart's webpage, Big Government, and I watched it and I was just appalled because
I'm not sure why it got cut off there, but why were you appalled, Judy? The suspense is killing me.
Well, because they had me saying things that I hadn't said in class, and they had spliced together, different things I said at different times, deleted words, and made it sound like I was, inciting my students to violence. Besides that, of course, I also changed shirts in the middle of a lecture, and it was just bizarre to see. I called it chop shop editing because they would just take a little piece from here and a little piece from there, and they put it together all to make Don and me look really bad. Mm-hmm. And what I had to do was go through it. I mean, we're talking about there were 4 classes I think they used. I had to go through 7 hours each and actually detail what came from where so that the administrators at UMKC could see what a fraud this thing was. And that took time. It took days. And I was in limbo for days and getting calls from the media saying, what are you doing? And I remember one woman sent me an email saying, how could you? And I responded back and said, I didn't. And she said, but I saw it with my own eyes. Yeah. And it's like people are so vulnerable, or they believe what they want to believe. But there was a lot of hate, really. It was a very scary time. I never thought I'd have to go through that. I mean, you're just a teacher,
right,
in a classroom.
Right. Yeah. Well, sorry to make you relive that.
Well, that's okay. It was good because, in the end, the provost really insisted that they do a real investigation because I think there were people who were calling for them to just fire me. And she insisted that I get due process. It's, this is an issue of academic freedom, and it's an issue of the right to due process, which is so important in the university, especially when you have, Tea Party folks with political motives who want to take advantage of the free speech we have in the classroom, which is what the case was here. I mean, this was clearly a Tea Party-backed attack. It was an attack on Don, and it came from St. Louis. And so protecting academic freedom is really, really important if we're going to have real education in our universities. And that really concerns me today because of the legislature right now is moving to actually, you know, take control of the university in ways that are very alarming to faculty. And I'm sure administrators as well. Yeah.
Well, and this whole thing of these groups like this, you know, twisting what's being said and making these things. Amy had talked in the news section of her show this morning about the guy that put together the whole thing on a Planned Parenthood and using the fetal tissue and selling that and all that. And, you know, that raised a lot of furor in Congress and even among some of the presidential candidates earlier in the race. And it was a totally put-together piece. And what Amy reported this morning was that the police or the Justice Department, I think it was Justice Department, has raided this guy's house and is taking equipment and things like that because it's been proven that he did, put this together out of pieces rather than this being a whole cloth.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, if I hadn't gone through this experience, I think I wouldn't be as willing to, you know, believe that people would stoop to those kinds of levels in politics. But I remember really clearly the student who stole the videos from our class, who gave them to the Breitbart people. Mm-hmm. He told Don, my co-teacher, he told Don that he believed that there were no ethics in politics whatsoever, that the whole point was to win. And it didn't matter how you did it. And that's clearly how he acted, in this case. And, you know, some real ironies because we knew he had told us that he was a Republican. And he participated actively in class discussions about labor unions. He was anti-labor. But that was okay. Mm-hmm. He said he wanted to go into politics and be a campaign coordinator and stuff like that. After he graduated, he was a senior actually at Wash U. He had taken this class specifically to get us.
Wow.
He had been sent to get us. Yeah. But after he graduated from Wash U, he did get a job. He went to work for Joe the Plumber in Ohio.
Really?
As his campaign manager. And, you know, well, we know what happened to Joe. So, of course, he's probably still around and who knows what. But, yeah.
Well, Joe the Plumber is actually working as a union employee somewhere now.
He's really?
Yes.
He's joined a union.
I read something about that.
That's
and I can't remember. He's in some factory or something or other where there's a union, and he's a union member now.
Aha.
So, hey, you know.
I wonder if he still votes Republican. But anyway, that's great.
Very good. So we set aside this time, and Tom Clymer having retired, tell somebody, because we knew Amy Goodman would be in town this week, and we wanted to get her on the phone. And we are going to get her on the phone in a little bit, because Amy's going to be here Saturday in an event at All Souls UU Church. The VIP is all sold out, but we still have plenty of the regular tickets left, but they are going fast. And you can either go to kkfi.org or call 816-931-3122 and ask for Bill to find out more about how to get those tickets. One thing about Saturday night's event, I don't know that either of you guys know. My friend Joseph Davis, I don't know if you know him. He's a poet and he loves KKFI. He, at the church where Amy's going to be, All Souls, they dedicated a Black Lives Matter banner several months back, and Joseph was asked to come up with a poem for that event. So he's going to be doing his Black Lives Matter poem right before Amy comes on. So that Black Lives Matter banner that was dedicated at All Souls got stolen, and I think that there was some publicity around that, and I think someone stepped up and donated another one.
It got stolen.
Yes, it's stolen.
They have installed a new banner. You know, this is one of the things that I always get from people is, you know, well, all lives matter. And I say, well, no, the problem is that until
all lives don't matter.
Until black lives matter, all lives don't matter.
Exactly.
You know, and this is one of those things. This is why we bring those voices onto KKFI.
Yeah.
You know, and why Amy Goodman brings them onto Democracy Now! Is because until we hear those voices and understand what they're feeling and what they're going through, we would believe well, of course, all lives matter, you know, but the fact is that, like I said, you know, those black lives don't matter. You know, if those black lives don't matter, then all lives don't matter.
Right, right. You know, and let me just say that you may listen to Democracy Now!, you know, regularly and think it's great. But it's a different experience to come down and actually meet Amy and hear her speak. Mm-hmm. You know, in my view, she's a national treasure. I mean, she has brought to journalism in a very popular and accessible way. She has brought to journalism a new kind of purpose, and she's really changed my views on what journalism needs to be, because, you know, she understands. She says in the book, you know, she says her purpose is to go where the silence is, and she. And her staff, and I have to really give her staff a lot of credit, dig up and find those folks who aren't being covered by the regular media, the commercial media. And they go to the people who are the movers and the shakers. I think, Jeff, you were saying that, you know, what Amy does is she's really creating the raw material that future historians will be using to write the history of the U.S. If the history of the U.S. doesn't cover our social movements, then they don't get how change happens. And Amy is one of the few people in the media who's really chronicling it. But just getting back to why people should go see her, because there's a kind of magnetism and charisma that she actually communicates that you really need to witness in person.
You know, she is one of the people that you know, is genuine, and she has an interest in and a concern for everyone that she meets, and it comes through when you meet her, and when you hear her talk, you understand that she really does care about the people that don't have a voice. She does care about those people. And, you know, what I really wanted to say was that, you know, you had talked about what I had said. Her shows are basically a living history. You know, usually when you listen to your nightly news or some news report, you're listening to some commentator or person on the show that's basically saying, hey, this is the way I see it. And what she tends to do is bring on the people who are living that moment. In other words, they're living that moment in history, and they're going to tell you what they're feeling and what's happening to them, which is, you know, like I say, it's a living history. I expect that Democracy Now!, the archives of Democracy Now! Are going to be the basis for an awful lot of what is written in history books down the road because of that very thing. She didn't, you know, she wasn't using somebody's worldview. She was bringing on the people who were actually living the incident at the time.
Yeah, well, I'll never forget. And actually, there's a chapter in the book about this, about her coverage of Charleston, South Carolina, and what happened last year there. Not just the killings of all the church people, but you know, the day after that woman, and I can't remember her name now, climbed the flagpole to tear down the Confederate flag. You know, she had her on the air. You know, you might get a soundbite from that person on the regular news. But, you know, to have a full 10-minute, 15-minute interview with somebody who actually did change history, you know, because by tearing down that, – that was a very symbolic act, but it was also an act which really moved people and caused change. And, you know, there you got a front row seat when you listen to Democracy Now, you know, to hear that stuff. So I think it's great. What's next, Mike?
Well, I did just hear from Dennis, so Amy should be calling in any minute, so we need to be prepared for that. Why don't we
well,
again, Amy's going to be here on Saturday night. The talk starts at 7:30 at All Souls UU Church. There are still tickets for the main event still available. The VIP is sold out, but we're going to have Amy. They'll be calling in just a minute. And
can I read my introduction?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So I wrote this because I thought we were going to have Amy for the whole hour, but I might as well use it. Last year, during a pledge drive, I was pitching for dollars for KKFI, of course, during Democracy Now!, and I made a grave admission. I admitted that I'm addicted to Democracy Now!, I confess that I schedule my morning around it if I can, and in fact, if I can't because I have a meeting or a class or something. You know, like I'm kind of grumpy until I download the podcast, you know, and I can get a fix. So, and every day, you know, like Democracy Now! Sets me up for the day, and it sets me up for the day because the news I get of the people and the movements, the people who are swimming upstream against the current, people who are creating new currents of resistance to injustice, all of that gives me a much more positive attitude towards my day. And it makes me feel like, you know, I'm not alone. I'm in really good company. So this year, Democracy Now! Is celebrating 20 years on the year. 20 years on the year. And it has, you know, both been carried along by, I think, what's a rising tide of people, of the social movement in this country, but it's also helped to shape it, and it's echoed it to itself, which has had a positive effect, I think. So, you know, it's clearly a part of that social movement, but it's also a reflection of that social movement. On the dust jacket to the book, it says that Democracy Now! Is the modern-day underground railroad of information, bringing stories from the grassroots to a global audience. And I'm really proud of the fact that KKFI broadcast the first program of Democracy Now! In 1996. We were one of those original stations that carried it, and we've been carrying it every day, every weekday since then. There were 9 stations, I guess, originally that Democracy Now! Was broadcast out. And so, you know, we're really honored to have Amy Goodman come and share a dinner and a talk with us this coming Saturday. So Amy is going to be on in a few minutes. And I'm Judy Ansel. And with me is Jeff Humfeld and Mike Murphy in the studio. We all have our own shows on KKFI, but I bet, you know, fess up, you're all addicts, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely. And that, in part, that's to inform me, not just of the subjects that she's dealing with, but how to create good radio and how to do the show that I do, you know, produce even better. And sometimes it gets show ideas.
Yeah, well, I wish I had the staff that Amy Goodman had for the Harlan Labor
all?
Farm. I mean, we have great volunteers, but most of them have other jobs.
Right.
You know.
Right. Exactly.
So we can't exactly devote full time to it, and you know, the research. I wanted to ask her about, you know, how they do their research and how they find the right person to interview, because it's awesome and it's usually, you know, spot on and factually checked out. You know, I have to hand it to them. I don't hear things that I think are mistakes too often on mm-hmm. Democracy Now. I think they have pretty good quality control. That's really important because their credibility depends on it. So
absolutely. Hey, we do have a couple of spots we need to play, so why don't we grab do those right now, because I think Amy will be calling in very soon.
The 11th annual Wyandotte County Ethnic Festival will be held at the Kansas City, Kansas Community College Fieldhouse on Saturday, April 16th from 11 to 5. More info at freewebs.com/WICO Ethnic Festival. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Congress will likely vote this year on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Judy Ansel is not only the producer of KKFI's Heartland Labor Forum, she is also the director of Worker Education and Labor Studies at UMKC. Jim Turner is the Missouri chapter liaison to the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program. They will explain how the TPP is even worse than past corporate-serving trade pacts. They'll break it all down for you 6 p.m. this Wednesday on the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
And here we are back in the KKFI studio. We're still waiting to get Amy Goodman on the phone, but Jeff Humfeld and Judy Ansel are here in the studio.
And they just did a PSA for the talk I did at All Souls. That's hilarious.
Yeah. So what was that talk on?
That was on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I've been a trade activist since NAFTA, really, and I teach this stuff. I teach a course called Labor in the Global Political Economy at UMKC, and so it's something I keep up with, and you know, get alarmed by because the TPP is like the biggest of the so-called free trade agreements. So I gave a talk at All Souls a couple weeks ago on that, along with Jim Tucker from the Sierra Club.
Turner, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. James Turner from the Sierra Club, who's actually a retired professor of business at Missouri State, and what do you call that? Truman State University.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So the two of us, you know, like he did the environmental stuff, and I did the labor and sort of the, and we both, you know, talked about the investor-state dispute settlement aspect, which allows these unelected judges or arbitrators in these trade tribunals, these lawyers, to actually trump our laws. Even Trump hates it.
Exactly. Well, you know, and this is one of the things, the argument back and forth on these trade deals is an argument that about manufacturing goods. That's what everybody thinks this is about.
Nah.
And the fact of the matter is that that's a very small part of it. You know, pharmaceuticals, how doctors do their job, you know, and healthcare is provided is part of this. I mean, it goes into so many different parts of our society and our economy that, you know, people don't have any idea that's what it is, and that's partially on purpose because they've done their very best to keep all of this stuff out of the view of not even just citizens like you or I, but also out of the view of our elected representatives.
True. I mean, the whole thing was secret. The process of negotiating was secret. When Congress members wanted to be able to read the text that had been agreed on during the process of negotiations, they had to go into a basement room in the Capitol. They could not take any pencil or paper because they weren't permitted to take notes, and they couldn't talk about it afterwards. A trade agreement that's 6,000 pages long and is going to affect hundreds, if not thousands, of laws, which will have to change because of the trade agreement. I mean, everything from, you know, our Buy America or Buy Missouri laws, procurement laws for government purchasing, you know, to the patent rights of pharmaceutical companies, to, you know, like how much Chinese content could be in your car, even though China isn't even part of the TPP. All of that is it's voluminous. You know, and I noticed that because the opposition, you know, so many of the candidates are against the TPP. I think the only candidate who's for it is Kasich, I think. There's the phone. Because of that, the Obama administration is now saying it's a security issue. It's not just about jobs. It's now because we need it for security.
Well, and let's face it, it's a treaty if it changes our laws.
It's not treated like a treaty.
And it's not voted on like a treaty.
We do have Amy Goodman on the phone. Are you there, Amy?
Yes, I am, and so excited to be on with you.
Yeah, thanks, Amy.
Hi, Amy. This is Judy Ansel.
And this is Jeff Humfeld.
Hi, welcome. So let's get started because we don't have much time. you're coming here on Saturday. It sounds like you have a full day on Saturday. You've only got three stops.
Well, the reason it's a lighter day, tomorrow we head to Columbus, Ohio, to the Ohio State University. Uh-huh. We do the show from New York, but Saturday and Sunday, we don't have the show, so it's only St. Louis in the morning at Left Bank Books, and then on to Columbia, Missouri. That's a wonderful community radio station, KOPN.
Right.
And we'll be doing a talk there. I'll be with Dennis Moynihan, co-author of the book. And then with you guys on Saturday night at 7:30 at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, we are so looking forward to celebrating KKFI with you and 20 years of Democracy Now.
Yeah. Well, I was just talking about the fact that, you know, like we're one of the few stations that had your first show on.
Right. You know, last night I was at Ithaca College, and they played clips from our first broadcast on February 19th, 1996. And it's so funny you say that, Judy, because I say welcome to everyone. We're on like 8 or 9 community radio stations. A big shout out to folks in Missouri, and that was your station.
That's great. So tell, I just got your book yesterday, and so I've read a little bit of it, and you start out by talking about the fact that you were in Haiti when you got the call that they wanted you to do this daily show. Talk about what were your expectations then, and how did it happen that we got Democracy Now?
Well, you know, I originally come out of Pacifica Radio, founded more than 60 years ago by a war resister who said there's got to be a media outlet not run by corporations that profit from war. There were five Pacifica stations developed, and then all of the affiliates and wonderful community radio stations like KKFI. And in 1996, Pacifica wanted to do a daily election show, and I had been talking about it with Samori Marksman, one of my mentors and heroes at WBAI, but then went down to Haiti, and I was covering elections there. Such a terrifying time, people afraid of the violence, and yet they would go out to the polls. I mean, I had covered the coup in Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide ouster, sadly, the U.S.-backed coup, but people were willing to come out and risk everything. And when I got the call to host this show, I thought, it's amazing that in the United States most people don't vote. We don't face anything like the adversity that people in other countries do. Why don't most people vote in the United States? Why is it that, I mean, I never thought people were apathetic. So what are they involved with? And we use the primary states as a way to look, just going from state to state, at what people were doing, what their involvement was, and why so many decided not to vote, even though I thought they were civically engaged. You know, was it that they didn't feel there was a real choice? Was it that they were barred from voting in some way or another? We have this horrific story in this country, the narrative that must be changed. Millions of people can't vote. First of all, you have people who've had any affiliation with being targets of the criminal justice system. You have people who've been in prison. Now, in some places, like Vermont and Maine, you can vote from prison. But in other places, you can't vote for the rest of your life if you have been convicted of a felony. Now, we believe in rehabilitation and people coming out of prison, right? We allow people out of prison, but they can't vote ever again. And then when it comes to the racial injustice and the criminal justice system, think about what this means for communities of color. 1 in 3 black men somehow in their lives will touch the criminal justice system. So we are talking about vast swaths of populations who can't vote. And these are all issues we must take on. And, you know, we talked about these issues and the fact that the caucus and primary, Iowa and New Hampshire, these were our first shows. You know, how interesting that the first election contests are in the whitest states in the country. And it's not just one state after another. These are the states that determine so much of the politics of the presidential year, right, as the election year gets longer and longer, right, as candidates come to Iowa earlier and earlier. We're talking about a tone setting that goes on for like a year beforehand. And we have to ask these questions. New Hampshire, one of the last states to recognize Martin Luther King's birthday, they finally did it after some Klan-like group came up to New Hampshire to thank the people of New Hampshire for not honoring Dr. King. They were so then, at that point, embarrassed and humiliated, they were forced to accept this. But Dennis Moynihan, my brother, a journalist, David Goodman from Vermont, and I have been pulling together the stories we've been covering on Democracy Now! For the past 20 years. And so in this 20th anniversary, have come out with Democracy Now! 20 years covering the movements changing America. And it's been such a fascinating journey to go back to bring out the voices of people at the grassroots dealing with so many different stories, from war and peace to immigration, the movements that have developed over the years to fight for equality, LGBT equality, to fight the growing gap between not just rich and poor, but the rich and the rest of us. I mean, these are issues, the movement for the $15 an hour minimum wage, certainly issues, Judy, you know well, and all of these movements, how they have made history over these years.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of the $15 movement, one of the people who's asked to come to meet you is Terrence Wise, who you had on the show, who's one of the leaders of the Fight for 15 here in Kansas City. So you're going to meet him Saturday night.
Fantastic. Oh, my gosh. I'm really looking forward to coming back to KKFI and having this celebration with everyone. And I hope everyone comes out. We'll be giving, we'll be speaking, also signing books. But you don't just have to get a book to come up. What's so nice about the book line is that I get to meet people individually. And I really look forward to that. And people telling me, first of all, meeting old friends, also meeting new friends, and stories that you think need to be covered. I hope people will write up things in advance if you think there's a story that needs to be covered. Think about people to be interviewed. As we travel the country, I hesitate to say, on this 100-city tour.
Oh,
I just can't even believe it exactly. So I came back this morning around 2:30 from Ithaca College in upstate New York, and we head to Columbus tomorrow. But then on from Kansas City to Los Angeles and Santa Barbara to San Francisco and to Stanford University to Santa Clara, Silicon Valley, and we'll be doing fundraisers for the mothership for the KPFA and KPFK stations in Los Angeles and in Berkeley, California. We'll be going to Utah, we'll be going to Colorado, and what I'm excited by, of course, New Mexico and all through the Northeast as well, is that this is the heart of Democracy Now! It is covering the movements that change history and that make history, and I think that's the power of it on Democracy Now! Every single day.
Well, Amy, this is Jeff, and I wanted to say, when people ask me about Democracy Now!, one of the things I tell them is that it's living history. In other words, you know, what you broadcast and the people that you bring on are the people that are living the events of our times. And one of the questions that Judy and I both have is, how do you find these people?
Well, I work with an amazing brain trust, heart trust of journalists who are deeply committed to independent media, and that's how we spend our days and nights, is finding the people closest to the story, not the pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong, but people who are engaged in their communities, involved in a story, who can express it in their own words, and it's the authenticity of that. You know, today I was just doing an interview before I came on the air with you, what we call a post-show. You know, after the show, we do extended interviews. Today with Melissa Harris-Perry, we kept her on. And, I mean, the first guest we talked to, Eric Fair, I mean, and he was an interrogator at Abu Ghraib and in Fallujah. You know, he's not a pundit who's telling us about it. He's not Ted Cruz or Donald Trump who says we want more torture. He is a man who did it himself and lives with the nightmares and what that means. Melissa Harris-Perry getting ultimately leaving MSNBC and talking about what that meant. The, you know, MSNBC talk show host, also political science professor at Wake Forest. But afterwards, we talked to Dave Isay, and folks who listen to NPR may know well StoryCorps, the clips of stories all over the country that people share with each other. You know, a loved one, you take your mother or father or co-worker into a StoryCorps booth. We have it at Grand Central in New York City, and he takes these all over the country. And you talk to each other for 40 minutes, and that tape of that conversation goes to the Library of Congress. It's the largest oral history project in the country. But I first met Dave when he walked into the studios of WBAI and asked us to do a story. And I said, well, why don't you do it, sir? He was so intent on this story. And I said, we don't have people to do it, but you seem so excited about it. Do it yourself. And I was the WBAI evening news editor at the time. And that's how it goes. And Dave has now done this astounding project, which he commits his life to. And it just reminds me, you know, listening, as he says, is an act of love. And I think that the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth because we hear each other on the radio. You don't have to agree with what you hear. How often do we even agree with our family members? But when you hear someone speaking for themselves, it breaks down bigotry and caricatures that fuel the hate groups. Who would think that in 2016, we're talking about the Klan, not in historical terms, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, for example, that blew up KPFT, the Pacifica station in Houston in 1970, because they didn't want to hear voices like those that were being broadcast. Yeah, that's 1970. But who would think in this presidential year that we're actually having a debate about the legitimacy of the Ku Klux Klan today? When you have Donald Trump wavering on whether he would disavow the support of the Klan and David Duke. I mean, it's astounding what we have come to, but also astounding how powerful movements are becoming, like immigrants' rights movement, like Black Lives Matter movement, like the Occupy movement of today, not of 2011. Yes, the encampments were eviscerated, but the idea that everyone knows what the 99% means, what the 1% means, that Occupy was the most used word that year. When you occupy the language, when you change the language, you change the world. And there is so much that is happening in our book, in Democracy Now!, the book. We chronicle the story of Bree Newsom. We were in South Carolina covering the horrible tragedy of Emanuel Church, where 9 people were killed last June by a white supremacist, right? Dylan Storm Roof. And we were just leaving South Carolina when we heard that some young African-American woman had shimmied up the flagpole on the South Carolina state grounds and brought down the Confederate flag, saying, this flag comes down today. Now, you might have thought Nikki Haley did it, right? The governor of South Carolina, who is hailed for leading the state legislature in voting to take down that symbol of hate. But it was actually a few weeks before that this young woman from North Carolina, a young artist and activist named Bree Newsom, shimmied up that flag and under great threat, not knowing what would happen to her, you know, knowing a Klan rally would happen in the coming hours and people carrying their guns. She shimmied up that flag and she said, this flag comes down today. What remarkable stories of people over these 20 years that we were so honored to capture in the book, Democracy Now!
You know, Amy, it's funny because I was just talking about that part of the book because that's such a great example of how, you know, Nikki Haley may get the credit, but in fact, people make history. And that's such a great example of the fact that, you know, history is made by the people and not just by these elected leaders. But, you know, I want to ask you, what your thoughts are in terms of the media coverage of the presidential campaign. A lot of us here think that, you know, obviously, you know, they're obsessed with Trump, but that the Bernie Sanders campaign is really getting short shrift by the media. They're very dismissive. How do you view it?
Well, you know, I've been invited on CNN twice in the last few weeks to comment on media coverage on Brian Stelter's show called Reliable Sources. And I took on CNN and MSNBC and Fox. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes when it comes to the uniform whiteout of Bernie Sanders' voice. You know, I mean, he is breaking every record in the book. In March, what he raised, $44 million, not from a few donors, but from the largest grouping of Americans ever. This was up against Hillary Clinton's $29.3 or $5 million. And, you know, she has a problem because he can raise money on the campaign trail in these public rallies, just saying give $3, $5, $10. I think the average is $27. She has to go off the trail into these private campaign fundraisers, and that takes her off the trail. And now they're fighting it out for the April 19th primary here in New York. But just look a couple Tuesdays ago. I think it was Super Tuesday 3. I think Marco Rubio had pulled out that night, so we heard his speech. And I might be conflating, too, but we heard John Kasich, you know, who had won Ohio, and Ted Cruz, and heard... well, then we were waiting on all these networks for Donald Trump. He had set up one of his Florida mansions like a news press room, and they said he was going to give a news conference in a few minutes. Hillary Clinton also spoke, and it was the week where there were five primaries and caucuses. She had won three, and it was too close to call for Missouri and her home state of Illinois. So it was really neck and neck, and all the networks were saying that. You know, they were saying it's not clear if Sanders or Clinton will take these two states. So they all spoke, the Republicans and the Democrats, except where was Bernie Sanders? Had he just, like, dropped out that night? What was going on? I mean, it was really close that night. And the networks were filling time, right? They're going all night on these elections. And I was watching CNN. They're showing an empty podium where Donald Trump was about to speak. And they kept hanging on, waiting, 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 showing the empty podium. And then he spoke for about half an hour, didn't take questions. It wasn't a news conference. And you never saw Bernie Sanders that night. Well, it turns out he had started speaking well before Donald Trump had gone to his podium, when they were all just waiting. And he was addressing, Sanders was addressing thousands of people in Phoenix, Arizona. Why weren't they playing a speech? They were just waiting, saying, Trump isn't here yet, Trump isn't here yet. And then they play the whole Trump speech. Where was Bernie Sanders? So the next day on Democracy Now!, of course, we played a clip of the Bernie Sanders speech. Who would think that's revolutionary? You know, all these guys give concession and victory speeches. It's not particularly revolutionary to play clips of them. But suddenly it's becoming radical just to play his voice. And we all know the pointer, what was it, the Kindle Center report of 2015 that said Donald Trump got something like 23 times the coverage of Bernie Sanders in that year. And why it matters, as Noam Chomsky says, is the media manufactures consent. And it's absolutely critical, if we're going to get away from the personalities and go to the issues, to hear what these people have to say on issues. I don't care if you're for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or for someone else entirely or for Ted Cruz or Donald Trump or John Kasich, but we got to hear what their positions are.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that I think is real important for people to understand, is that the third rail of politics is no longer Social Security. It's media consolidation. If you say you're going to break up the media, you're sunk. They're going to sink you. They're going to go after you, and they're going to make sure you're either frozen out or you're made a fool of. One of the two.
Hey, I want to add one more thing. Amy, you're not the only celebrity who's coming to Kansas City this week. Turns out that...
I am not a celebrity. Let's set the record straight here.
All right. It turns out that the Truman Presidential Library tonight is awarding its Wild About Harry Award to none other than Henry Kissinger. And he's going to be speaking tonight in Kansas City. I certainly hope that somebody's there to protest it because, you know, I think if you listen to Democracy Now! Over the years, you would have gotten the idea that maybe he should be arrested, not awarded. But anyway, you got anything to say about that?
You know, it's so interesting. I didn't know this until you're just saying it, Judy, but last night I was speaking about Henry Kissinger in my Ithaca College address, talking about having to have a uniform standard of justice. Look at 9/11. Look at what happened. You know, 3,000 people incinerated in